If you have hyperthyroidism or Hashimoto's and are looking to save your thyroid, then you might want to take the 60-second Save My Thyroid quiz to find out how likely it is that you can save your thyroid. Upon completing the quiz, you will receive your thyroid saving score and a free report explaining your unique results, along with some things you can do to regain your health. To take the quiz, visit savemythyroid.com/quiz. Thank you for joining me on the Save My Thyroid podcast, where I help people save their thyroid and regain their health. My name is Dr. Eric Osansky, and if you have hyperthyroidism, then you will especially benefit from these episodes. If you have hypothyroidism or Hashimoto's thyroiditis, you will also find many of the episodes to be valuable. In this episode, I interview Dr. Angela Mazza as she discusses everything you need and want to know about radiofrequency ablation. If you have larger thyroid nodules, you definitely will want to listen to this interview. Please make sure you check out the post-episode chat after the outro music, as I'll expand on our conversation about the radioactive iodine uptake test, choosing between radiofrequency ablation and thyroid surgery, and I'd also like to talk about addressing the cause of the condition when doing RFA. Anyway, here is my interview with Dr. Mazza.
Welcome to the Save My Thyroid podcast, hosted by Dr. Eric Osansky. To stay up to date on the latest thyroid health-related topics, visit SaveMyThyroid.com. The following discussion is for educational purposes only and is not intended to diagnose or treat any disease. Please do not apply any of this information without first speaking with your doctor. Now let's head to the show.
Really excited about this interview here. I have Dr. Angela Mazza, who is a triple board certified doctor in endocrinology, diabetes, and metabolism, as well as internal medicine and anti-aging and regenerative medicine. So Dr. Mazza's broad medical background includes significant research in both basic and clinical realms of endocrinology. And Dr. Mazza is the founder of Metabolic Center of Wellness. I know you told me. I'll let you say it. Aveto, Florida.
Yeah.
Aveto, Florida, where she spends a great majority of her time caring for persons with autoimmune thyroid disease, thyroid nodules, and thyroid cancer. Highly regarded for her individualized approach to patient care, Dr. Mazza empowers each person to achieve their unique goals by providing education, lifestyle management, and support. And Dr. Mazza believes that hormonal changes that happen in women and men as they age play a huge part in their overall health, longevity, and quality of life. Her passion is helping her patients achieve metabolic as well as hormonal balance. And we're going to be chatting about radiofrequency ablation. Again, I'm really excited. And thank you for joining us, Dr. Mazza.
Thanks so much for inviting me. I'm happy to be here.
Yeah. So let's go ahead. If we could start off, well, I gave you a background. So I guess really, how did you start helping people with radiofrequency ablation? Because there still aren't a lot of doctors that do this across the United States. And I know you're currently the only one in Central Florida who does this procedure. So yeah, if you could talk about how long you've been doing it and how you started incorporating this into your practice.
Sure. Well, I've been taking care of patients with thyroid nodules for years. And up until, you know, a few years ago, this therapy, radiofrequency ablation, wasn't even available or FDA approved in the United States. So before that time, I was having to send patients to surgery for nodules that couldn't otherwise be treated. And unfortunately, going to surgery, oftentimes they'd end up on thyroid hormone replacement. So for something that really should have been so easy to treat. So RFA has been used for years, even here in the United States, for different tumors like liver, lung, kidney. It's even been used for the heart and for varicose veins. But it wasn't until 2012 it was started to be used for thyroid nodules, believe it or not, in South Korea by Dr. Baek, who's kind of like the father of RFA for thyroid nodules. And it took that long, with all the data that was happening, all the proven benefits that were going on, for the United States to approve it. So once I started hearing about this exciting research that was ongoing all over the world, I was like, well, once this is FDA approved, this is something I totally want to be able to provide for my patients. Because I was doing thyroid biopsies, thyroid ultrasounds, and unfortunately just didn't have any choice for some nodules to have to go to surgery. So once it was available, I was like, yes, I have to be able to provide this.
All right. I'm sure a lot of people listening are familiar with what thyroid nodules are, but I'm still going to ask you if you could explain what they are, how common they are, what are some of the causes or common causes of thyroid nodules?
Sure. Thyroid nodules are super, super common. about one in three persons sometime in their lifespan is going to have some sort of thyroid nodule. That's how common they are. And there's nodules that have different kind of characteristics. Some nodules are more cystic and they become fluid filled. Some nodules are more solid and they're hard. Some are kind of a mix of both. We call them complex. And then there's nodules that are more concerning, which are cancerous. But that is a good question. What causes thyroid nodules? Up until recently, we always just kind of threw it off to iodine deficiency. I think that's kind of an unfair blanket statement to say that all nodules are caused by iodine deficiency because all nodules are a little bit different. That just doesn't make sense. But what we're finding is that the thyroid is so sensitive to inflammation. And sometimes these nodules can be a result of inflammation in the body and then in turn cause inflammation in our thyroid. Now, different nodules behave differently. So these cystic filled nodules, sometimes they just keep filling up with fluid and they become a problem. Sometimes nodules are just small and they don't cause any issue and we just leave them alone and just watch. But every nodule, it's important to be able to characterize and say, all right, these are ones we can watch. These are ones that are causing issues. These are ones that are suspicious. So I hate to say thyroid nodules are like snowflakes, but they kind of are. They're all a little bit different. So it's a tough question to answer to say what's the cause of them.
When you do an ultrasound and you detect thyroid nodules, then it sounds like maybe not all of them require follow-up. It depends on the characteristics.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I mean, if some are really tiny little cysts, they have just fluid and they're just tiny and they have certain characteristics that we can see on the ultrasound, they might not even be worth following. So they're so benign. And there's a grading system that's been developed to look at what are the concerning characteristics? What are ones we have to follow more closely? What are ones we have to biopsy? And what are the ones that need to be addressed as far as either surgical removal or some sort of more proactive therapy?
So in my practice, I see a lot of people with both Graves and Hashimoto's, but I focus a little bit more on the hyperthyroid side. Yeah. And so other than Graves' disease, we do see some cases of toxic multinodular goiter. So can you talk a little bit about toxic nodules? And again, we're going to get into the RFA, you know, can it help with toxic nodules? But if you could describe like what toxic nodules are, maybe also like for those who are unfamiliar with the term, like hot nodule versus cold nodule.
Okay. Toxic nodules are essentially overactive nodules. So these are nodules that are starting to make their own thyroid hormone and not listening to the signals to stop making thyroid hormone. Now, toxic nodules have a very distinct look on the ultrasound. They're really hypervascular. And that's what feeds into these nodules to make them keep being overactive. And in certain cases, can cause them to be quite large. As far as therapies for toxic nodules, actually, the difference between cold and hot nodules, or a hot nodule is considered a toxic nodule because when there's certain imaging that we can order. I don't use this imaging as much anymore. It's kind of like not needed. But there used to be these scans called radioactive iodine uptake scans using these for toxic nodules. So say someone shows up with a nodule, we're not really sure what it is. So before biopsy was around, we would send them for these radioactive iodine uptakes. And wherever in the thyroid nodule it got taken up would be a hot nodule if it was a nodule. So it would glow, so they would call it hot. Now, they used to say nodules that didn't take up anything were cold and they were suspicious. They were, oh no, they might be cancer. We kind of got away from calling cold and non-functioning nodules suspicious for anything because we know that's not true. You do a biopsy, most of the time they come back fine. Hot nodules just kind of just light up. So we can use that term hot, but it also means toxic or hyperfunctioning. But up until recently, the only treatments we had for hot nodules were, one, we can put people on medicine. So anti-thyroid medicines to really kind of to cool off that overactive nodule, especially if it's causing problems like symptoms of hyperthyroidism. So if someone's feeling hyperthyroid, they're feeling hot, they're feeling shaky, having trouble sleeping, having palpitations, all the symptoms that go along with overactivity. So the medicine can kind of cool that off. But when we're talking about toxic nodules, those, unlike Graves' disease, where sometimes we can get people off antithyroid medicine, toxic nodules don't tend to shut down on their own with that type of medicine. The second treatment is radioactive iodine. So just like that radioactive iodine uptake scan, a different amount of radioactive iodine is used to be taken up by that nodule and shut it down or essentially just turn off its machinery. Sometimes that works. Sometimes it causes a whole thyroid to become underactive, which is a downside. Sometimes these people need another dose of radioactive iodine, but it is radioactive iodine still. That carries with it its own concern. And then surgery would be the other option, to just take out that side of the thyroid or the whole thyroid. But until recently, radiofrequency ablation has been a treatment option available for persons with overactive thyroid nodules. So it's kind of a new tool in our toolbox for hot nodules.
Which is awesome. And again, we're going to dive into that. But one thing I want to ask you, you mentioned the radioactive iodine uptake test. And I still notice a lot of endocrinologists still use that. So it sounds like you stopped using it in your practice.
I can't even tell you the last time I ordered a radioactive iodine uptake scan. It's been, I want to say it's almost been 10 years. Because that's why ultrasound is so great. I have an ultrasound in my office. I say, okay, you've got nodules. Let's take a look under the ultrasound. If I'm looking at the thyroid gland, I see the nodule. There's super vascularity going on. It's a toxic nodule. End of story. You don't even really need to biopsy a toxic nodule because they're 99.9% always benign.
So I'm glad you mentioned the ultrasound and biopsy, because I mean, some will justify using the radioactive iodine uptake test to prove or not prove, again, give hints if it's cancerous. But like you said, even if it's a cold nodule, it doesn't mean that it's cancerous. Most of the time, it's not going to be cancerous. So why not just do the ultrasound, and then depending on the characteristics of the ultrasound, determine if someone needs a biopsy. And it sounds like that's the approach you take in your practice.
Yeah. And I mean, as a skilled ultrasonographer, I mean, you just get used to seeing these nodules and you start to be able to see different characteristics. But yeah, those radioactive iodine uptake scans, they're a pain for the patients and they're oftentimes not accurate. I mean, they're just, it's not worth the time and energy.
Yeah. Thank you. I'm glad you mentioned that because I've been saying that for years.
Yeah, you were right.
Yeah. Try not to knock other endocrinologists who use it, but just not a big fan. I just don't understand why. Another reason why some will use it is to diagnose Graves' disease. But if someone has hyperthyroidism in the presence of the elevated autoantibodies, like, you know, the elevated TSI, then we know they have Graves' disease. They don't need the uptake, you know, for that. So there's like different reasons they give for doing the uptake test. But to me, it's just never made sense.
I mean, you could plead a case for like a thyroiditis versus Graves, but even then you're going to see different changes on the ultrasound that you still don't need the, you don't need the uptake scan.
All right. So let's get into radiofrequency ablation. So if you could describe what it is, when is it indicated?
Sure. Yeah. So I kind of mentioned that radiofrequency ablation has been used like for years and years for other things. But radiofrequency ablation is great for benign and toxic nodules or hot nodules. So essentially, it's using an electric current to go directly into the nodule and causing tissue, I hate to say damage, but essentially it's agitating the tissue and it causes long-term ablation in the nodule itself. It's great because it leaves the rest of the thyroid completely intact. You're only working on the nodule itself. This procedure, as opposed to surgery, and there's surgery is great for some things and for many things, but this is done in the office. There's no anesthesia. There's no downtime from work. There's no thyroidectomy scar. It's just kind of a nice alternative that we never had until recently here in the States.
And you mentioned just before that it could help with toxic nodules, which is great.
I mean, some nodules are a little more challenging than others for RFA and may require more sessions. Toxic nodules, depending upon the size, since they're so vascular, oftentimes require more than one session. But still, I mean, it beats surgery and all that goes along with the possible risks of surgery.
So like a single toxic nodule sometimes will need multiple treatments?
Yeah. Depending on the size of the nodules in general, I've been seeing some very, very large nodules, and you really can only ablate for a certain amount of time because you want to keep it within safe time periods because you are dealing with like electric current within the nodule. So you just don't want to over ablate. But most nodules can be taken care of in one session.
Okay. One of the questions I had, which I think you kind of answered it, but I'll ask it anyway. If someone comes in and let's say it's not toxic nodules, but just larger benign nodules, you know, maybe like 2-3 centimeters or greater. And they're currently seeing an endocrinologist that's saying, hey, you know, you just got to take the thyroid out. So if they need to get more than one nodule removed, typically it would be like one nodule per visit, per session. Would that be fair to say? Or it depends?
It kind of depends. It depends upon the size of the nodule and the positioning of the nodule. If they're kind of on in the isthmus and on one side, we can try and do more than one at a time. If they're on both sides or bilateral, generally, depending upon the size of the nodule, I'll do just one side, then the other. It's a procedure. We're trying to be cautious of the patient's comfortability also, because the patient is awake during the surgery. I usually give a little bit of anxiolytic beforehand, just because it's kind of nerve-wracking, because you hear the generator going, but we keep trying to talk to the patient during the procedure. That serves two purposes. It makes me know that they're doing okay, plus it also helps me monitor their voice during the procedure. Because one of the things, surgery as well, is there's a risk of recurrent laryngeal damage. Very, very low compared to surgery. But as long as we monitor their voice, it's a good kind of gauge of how things are going. Plus, it gives me an idea of how comfortable they are.
Should someone who goes through the procedure, should they expect to experience any discomfort at all?
Well, it's kind of like the biopsy, but a lot longer. So if you've ever been through a biopsy, your neck is extended. Unlike a biopsy, there are a lot of numbing medicine to the area. So we give about 10 milliliters of lidocaine. That serves a number of purposes. The thyroid itself doesn't have nerves, but the thyroid capsule has nerves, and the surrounding tissues have nerves. So when we inject the lidocaine not only numbs the capsule, but it also separates the structures of the neck out. So it separates out the carotid artery, separates, kind of protects the recurrent laryngeal nerve. So it serves multi-purpose. So to answer your question, the patient should not have discomfort during the surgery, but pressure is normal because I'm leaning on your neck with an ultrasound for up to like 30, 40 minutes. So we take breaks. Like I'll say, are you all right? You know, take a break. Plus the other thing that patients often comment on, because we're using it's a probe. Not unlike a needle that's done for a biopsy, but the probe, as I'm using it, I'm going to systematically to different parts of the nodule and ablating each area. And sometimes they'll feel like a little pop because that's the thyroid tissue being ablated. It's a weird feeling. It's not more of a pain, but it's kind of unexpected if you're not aware of it.
Okay. And on average, how long does the procedure take? I'm sure it varies depending on the person, but
yeah, in whole, I would have to say, start where we do a baseline ultrasound to the end of the ablation, from an hour to an hour and a half.
Okay, that's not too bad. Hey, this is Dr. Eric, and if you're looking to do everything you can to save your thyroid gland, in addition to listening to this podcast, there are a few different ways we can help you. First of all, I've written a book on hyperthyroidism called Natural Treatment Solutions for Hyperthyroidism and Graves' Disease, as well as a book called Hashimoto's Triggers, which of course is on Hashimoto's thyroiditis, and you can find both of these on Amazon as well as other websites where books are sold. Second, you could also join my Graves' Disease and Hashimoto's healing community by visiting autoimmunethyroidgroup.com. And finally, if you want to get personal help from me, you could visit the website workwithdrerick.com. Just to let you know, I only see a limited number of new patients each month, and I do require anyone interested to complete a brief online application before working with me. And now back to the show. Once the ablation is done, and let's say they just have a single nodule and they only needed that single visit, do they typically need follow-up visits after that to just monitor it?
Yes. Right after the procedure, patients really don't have any restrictions. I mean, you don't want to do any heavy lifting or anything like that for a day. But as far as the follow-up, I recommend doing an ultrasound in about 2 months after with some repeat thyroid function tests, then at 6 months, and then at least at 12 months. And we have a lot of patients that come out of town for this procedure. So I'm reliant upon other ultrasound reports and ultrasound images to do follow-up on those cases. It's nicer when I can do my own ultrasounds for follow-up because since this is a new procedure, a lot of the radiologists aren't used to reading what does a nodule look like after it's ablated. It can look actually suspicious to them because some of the markings that go along with suspicious nodules can look similar to where areas have been ablated within the thyroid. So that can cause a little confusion. That's why I like to do my own if I can. But as long as I have the disc to really look at the images, that's part of the follow-up. So we tend to see the best results right around 6 months to 12 months, because even though we've ablated tissue during the procedure, that conductive heat is continuing to ablate tissue within the nodule up until that time period. The 2 month follow-up is just so I can make sure everything looks like it's going in the right direction.
Yeah, makes sense.
Yeah. And
speaking of suspicious nodules, I don't think yet RFA is indicated for suspicious or malignant nodules. Do you think that's something that maybe in the future? We were chatting about this a little bit before we went live, that I've done my research, and I'm sure there's a lot of studies I haven't read, but I'm pretty sure I came across like one or two studies where it showed it actually can potentially help with malignant nodules as well, at least in the research studies.
Right. The ongoing studies are super promising, and it's mainly, they're just looking at low risk papillary cancer. So papillary cancer is the most common type of thyroid cancer. So they're looking at smaller, like 1.5 or less centimeter nodules and RFA. And it's been found to be as safe, if not safer than surgery, and a potential therapeutic option. So the results thus far have been really good.
And is there any chance or risk of the nodule growing back years later after removing it with RFA?
Yeah, there is that potential risk. I mean, we're trying to get everything within that nodule. Success defined as far as the research study is a volume reduction of 75% at 6 to 12 months. So that's considered success of the RFA. So that holds with it if there is a little bit of thyroid tissue left, especially if it's one of those more vascular nodules, there is the potential for the nodule to grow back and require another session down the line. That's kind of the good thing of doing serial ultrasound. So even doing an ultrasound once a year, you can stay ahead of this and it would be less of an RFA procedure down the line. But ideally, that's not the goal, but I always let my patients know there is the potential for some of it to grow back, especially the toxic nodules. They're the most challenging.
Yeah. Well, I guess, I mean, everything comes down to risk versus benefits. And I know if I was facing thyroid surgery due to nodules, I'm pretty confident that I would go the RFA route. And I'm not saying that just because I'm interviewing you. I mean, just the name of my podcast is, you know, Save My Thyroid. And so that's right. My goal, just like you try to save thyroid. So, you know, if I happen to have the nodule removed, then, you know, I would hope it wouldn't grow back, but still, if it did, you know, I guess I would just consider having it again. But you have to consider the potential consequences of thyroid surgery. A lot of people have thyroid surgery and they do okay. But as you said, there's, you know, the risk of the, you know, damage to the laryngeal nerve, the parathyroid glands. And again, not that there's absolutely zero risk with RFA, but just in comparison to surgery. So I still think in many cases, I don't know if I should use the word no-brainer, because I know it's not an easy decision when choosing for some people between RFA and surgery. You know, we were also chatting where currently, in most cases, insurance, you know, doesn't cover it, you know, so they might have to pay out of pocket for it. But still, you know, just in the day of high deductibles and being on thyroid hormone replacement permanently after getting surgery, again, you really got to look at the long picture and not just, even if someone's thyroid surgery is completely covered by their insurance, you know, and it's easy to say that I'm not in that situation, but still, I'm pretty sure I still wouldn't go the surgery, even if it was 100% covered. And if I had to pay, you know, out of pocket for the RFA, just because of the potential consequences the surgery can have.
Right. And just replacing your own thyroid with thyroid hormone replacement, it's tricky. I mean, not everybody feels great on the same thing. And I think it's a quality of life thing after. I think sometimes people make the knee-jerk decision, all right, I just want to get rid of the nodule. I'm going to do the surgery and just take thyroid medicine for the rest of my life. But you don't think about the long-term consequences. So, I mean, even like the best thyroid combination and, you know, I mean, not everybody feels great afterwards.
A question also that just came up, experience. So like if someone does undergo thyroid surgery, they probably want to choose a surgeon who has a lot of experience. So, you know, you've now been doing RFA for a while. Do you think that plays a role too? Like the longer someone's been doing it, the better?
It's definitely a learning curve. I mean, even from when I first started doing biopsies in fellowship, I mean, it takes a while to get good at it. I mean, fellowship was a long time ago, so this is a little bit different. But yeah, the more you do them, you kind of get, you know, what to look out for, you know, people, you know, potential issues during the procedure, whether it's the generator issue or issues with the electrode. I mean, there's so many steps involved that to say you're an expert right out the gate is very naive. So we've been doing them here in my office now since 2019. So it definitely is a learning curve. But like with anything, I mean.
Yeah. I understand. And any other risks or side effects that people should be aware of with RFA?
Yeah, I mean, the most common side effects right after the procedure is include tenderness. I mean, we've been working on an area of your neck up to like a half hour, 45 minutes. It's going to be a little tender. Some temporary hoarseness is not uncommon. I'm not talking voice loss, but just some hoarseness, some bruising in that area. It shouldn't be bruising all over your neck. Just be some localized bruising that may extend up and down the length of your thyroid area. Sometimes patients have a little bit of a burn mark there because from the electrode going into the thyroid itself. Those are the most common side effects. Very rare side effects. The most rare is that recurrent laryngeal nerve injury. Less also rare is something called capsular rupture, which that happens with people over-ablating a nodule for too long. So essentially the capsule gets disrupted. So that's why we don't keep the ablation times within the time period.
And do you do in your office ethanol ablation? Can you talk about, I know there's ethanol ablation, there's laser ablation, maybe compare the different types. And I think ethanol ablation is more for cysts. Is that
right? So percutaneous ethanol injection, or you might see it termed PEI, those are great, mostly cystic nodules. So those are the nodules that mainly filled with just fluid. So essentially with the PEI, we drain out the fluid. Now, oftentimes people who've had cystic nodules know that these nodules will fill up. They'll have been through this before. They'll have been through a biopsy where they aspirated everything and then it grew right back. These are the people that work really well for the PEI or even just fluid-filled nodules. So essentially with a PEI, we also use the ultrasound for guidance. We drain out the fluid as much as you can. Oftentimes I'll leave a little pocket because that's where I'm going to put the alcohol in. So we use a special kind of dehydrated alcohol. What that does is it fibrosis the inside of that nodule down so that it does not fill up with fluid again. So that's a pretty quick procedure. That one probably is closer to the time, even less than a biopsy. Plus is a PEI, super simple. We might need to do another PEI if it does fill up a little bit. Some of these really large nodules, you think you got as much as you could out as far as aspiration, and they find a way to just fill up a little bit more. Sometimes have to redo it, and it can sometimes burn a little bit depending upon where the nodule's at, but that's about it. As far as like laser, is great for larger nodules. It's a little more cumbersome than RFA. So RFA, we're using like a probe. It's a fine needle tip that I can go right in each and every section of the nodule. So laser is more like diodes. There's like a few diodes that go into the nodule. You don't have as much control, but I don't do laser, but some people do really well with laser. When we look at head-to-head studies, RFA is still superior in efficacy than laser.
Okay. Yeah. I don't see a lot of research, at least compared to RFA. It seems like there's a lot more with RFA and thyroid nodules.
Not as much. But there are practitioners that do laser and they have good results. So we at our clinic, we just only do PEI or RFA.
And with the PEI, that's just for cystic nodules. If someone has a solid nodule,
it doesn't work as well. I mean, there are studies on more heterogeneous or complex nodules. It's not as good. You can like instill as much alcohol into those nodules and they're just going to laugh at it. And you'd be like, no.
Okay. All right. Well, is there anything else that you'd like to discuss or anything I didn't ask you that I should have asked you?
Sure. Probably some people ask who's a good candidate for RFA and who would not be a good candidate. So candidates that are really good are people who have a nodule that's bothersome, whether it's cosmetic, where you see it from the outside, whether it's compressing, like compressing on, sometimes very large nodules compress on the windpipe. It can make breathing difficult or make swallowing difficult. If some of these nodules, when they're very large, like when you're lying flat, you can't breathe, or you have trouble like exercising because they're just pressing on the windpipe. So these people are great candidates for RFA. People who've had previous lobectomy, they don't want to damage or lose the thyroid function they have in the remaining thyroid. This is being looked at for recurrence of thyroid cancer, so that's something to consider. And there's people who are really afraid of surgery or just don't want to have surgery. These are people that are good for RFA. So that's kind of the list of potential good candidates. People really aren't ideal candidates are people who have pacemakers or defibrillators or have severe heart disease or on blood thinners that can't be stopped for a couple of days before the procedure and patients who are pregnant. So as of right now, those are probably not the best candidates.
Okay. So it sounds like getting back to like if someone has a partial thyroidectomy and then, you know, they have some nodules, you know, on the thyroid that's left, the half of the thyroid that's left, they can undergo RFA rather than get the other half of the thyroid removed.
Yeah, because if that thyroid's working well, if you want to preserve what you have, like save the rest of your thyroid rather.
All right. Well, this was wonderful. Again, I was really excited to chat with you about RFA, and you know, I'm sure we're going to hear more and more about it in the future. But I think, you know, again, now it's a really good option for a lot of people who are potentially facing thyroid surgery just because there are still a lot of endocrinologists who aren't aware of it. I mean, is it safe to say that the average endocrinologist, they're not aware of it, or maybe they are aware of it, but just aren't too familiar with it? So that's why still a lot of endocrinologists are going to recommend the surgery route.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of mixed. I honestly think that a lot of endocrinologists don't know about it. And I think some endocrinologists are waiting for more data, although there is a lot of data already on they're not convinced because they haven't seen enough patients go through it to say, all right, well, I had this patient who had RFA. They did great. So I think the more we get the word out about it, the more we educate other providers about it, I think it's going to be more and more acceptable because they'll see the results are really good. And, you know, if patients themselves had an option, I think they would prefer not to have surgery rather than surgery if it was all feasible.
Yeah, I agree. And, you know, I hate mentioning it here, but I think I feel the need just, you know, you would hope that in most cases, endocrinologists are going to do what is best for the patient. But, you know, my guess is also surgery is a lot more profitable than RFA. And so, yeah. Again, you know, you would hope that's not why they're recommending surgery, but yeah. As RFA becomes more popular, you would hope again more, and I think you will see more and more endocrinologists incorporating it or referring out, but still, you know, I'm sure there are some that just, hey, you know, I don't know how much average surgery, you know, is, but compared to RFA, it's, yeah. So right. Anyway, I just wanted to bring not to say that most endocrinologists have that motive to make money off the surgery, and that's why they recommend radioactive iodine. Radioactive iodine probably isn't that profitable.
And if you're in a hospital-based practice, maybe they would want internal referrals. But I mean, if you're coming to an endocrinologist, I feel like we should be able to give all the options. If you're going to an ENT or a surgeon, I mean, I get that they're going to recommend surgery. That's what they do. But as I mentioned too, when we were speaking earlier, right now, this is all very patient-driven. I mean, patients who are being proactive about their health and wanting other options, these are the patients that are going for the RFA because they know that surgery is not what they want and they want other options. So even when their doctors are telling them, get the surgery, they're finding more research.
All right. Well, again, thank you so much, Dr. Mazza. And where can people find out more about you? If you could share your website. I know you also have your own podcast as well.
Yeah. So our website is metabolic centerforwellness.com. We do have a podcast once monthly. Me and my friend Dawn, who is a friend as well as patient, she gives a patient's perspective. It's called Thyroid Talk with Dr. Angela Mazza. We try and make it fun. As fun as certain topics can be, right? So
yeah, I've listened to a few episodes. I enjoyed it.
A little silly sometimes, but what are you going to do? But yeah. And then I have a YouTube channel. It's just Dr. Angela Mazza.
All right. Wonderful. I'll make sure to include those links in the show notes. And yeah, again, thank you so much. It really was a pleasure chatting with you about RFA.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate the invite.
Thank you for listening to the Save My Thyroid podcast. If you haven't done so already, make sure you hit subscribe to stay up to date on the latest thyroid health-related topics. And to get your free thyroid and immune health restoration action points checklist, visit SaveMyThyroidChecklist.com. Thanks so much for tuning in.
I really did enjoy interviewing Dr. Angela, as it's rare to speak with an endocrinologist who also would like to save people's thyroids. In case if you couldn't tell, I was thrilled when she said that she doesn't do the radioactive iodine uptake test on her patients, as I couldn't agree with her more that in most cases, this is an unnecessary procedure. I honestly think that a lot of endocrinologists still use it because it's more profitable than a thyroid ultrasound. And in fact, when I dealt with Graves' disease, the endocrinologist I saw told me not to do it because I didn't have health insurance. So that was the first sign that maybe doctors recommend this test because of the profit involved. And so when it comes to RFA, radiofrequency ablation versus surgery and radioactive iodine, again, there's definitely a time and place for thyroid surgery. So I can't say that if you're listening to this and you receive thyroid surgery, maybe it was necessary. But if you have one or more larger thyroid nodules, and if your endocrinologist told you that surgery or radioactive iodine are the only options, I would at least look into radiofrequency ablation, especially if you've been told that the thyroid nodules are benign. If they're malignant, that is a completely different story. But as I mentioned to Dr. Mazur during an interview, I think there is some research that suggests that it might, at least in the future, be approved for some cancerous nodules. But for now, if it's benign, something to consider. Now, that being said, most people with thyroid nodules don't need to get radiofrequency ablation. And even if you get radiofrequency ablation, you do want to address the cause of the thyroid nodule. And I discussed this in episode number 33. There's an episode I put together, Thyroid Nodules, What You Need to Know. And I'll include the link to this in the show notes. But Dr. Mazza did bring up inflammation. So it does make sense to try to address sources of inflammation. But then with my research, I also found that problems with estrogen metabolism, whether it's an estrogen dominance condition, but it doesn't necessarily have to be an estrogen dominance condition. It's not synonymous, estrogen dominance, problems with estrogen metabolism. It could be one and the same. But either way, you want to look into that. And dried urine testing or the Dutch test is one way to look at the estrogen metabolites. Some practitioners will look at blood tests. And, you know, I mean, if you do a blood test for estradiol or total estrogens and it's elevated, then that's a pretty good indication that someone might have problems with estrogen metabolism and or an estrogen dominance condition. And then also some research shows that insulin resistance could be a factor when it comes to thyroid nodules. So that's something else that you might want to look into. And then I'm pretty sure she mentioned iodine deficiency as a potential cause of thyroid nodules. Now, there's a lot of controversy when it comes to iodine and thyroid health. And sometimes iodine can worsen thyroid health, worsen thyroid autoimmunity, and in some cases, worsen thyroid nodules. Now, I'm pretty sure I mentioned in past episodes, I'm not against iodine. If anything, I'm more in favor of iodine. I'm just very cautious about people taking iodine, especially large doses of iodine or doing iodine, even in small doses without testing. And when I say small doses, I don't mean iodine in a multivitamin or food sources of iodine, unless if it's really large amounts, like, you know, someone's eating sea vegetables, seaweed on a regular basis, that might be a different story. But I'm not scared of iodine, but when someone supplements with iodine, I've just seen so many different things. I've seen the good and bad. So I'm not going to get into great detail because that's not what this post-episode chat's about. But that's really what I wanted to discuss. Just radiofrequency ablation, obviously, it's not addressing the cause of the problem, but it could be something that can save your thyroid. It has saved many people's thyroids. And so that's why I wanted to interview Dr. Mazza. There are other doctors who perform radiofrequency ablation, still not a lot, but that number will only increase in the future. But whether you get radiofrequency ablation or not, if you have thyroid nodules, and even if you have smaller thyroid nodules, I would say you still want to try to do things to address the cause of the thyroid nodule whenever possible. And really the only way to know if it's helping is to do follow-up ultrasounds. But really, I just want to emphasize for anyone who's considering radiofrequency ablation, you do want to do things to address the cause of the problem. I want to let you know about a product called Hepatoimmune Supreme, which is a unique supplement that has a rare combination of N-acetylcysteine, also known as NAC, milk thistle, and schisandra to support the liver. And it also has a few mushrooms that can help support the immune system, including cordyceps, which has both immune modulating and adaptogenic properties and is great for those with Graves' disease and Hashimoto's. To learn more about Hepatoimmune Supreme, visit savemythyroid.com/liver support.